All right, Acts, the 25th chapter, and Paul, if you're visiting with us, Paul is now at Caesarea, and he's gone through a trial, basically, a hearing at least, and the Jewish leaders have set forth their case, and Paul has set forth his case, and they haven't found anything that he has done wrong. They haven't been able to prove their case. That is, the Jews have not been able to. And you remember, of course, we dealt with Felix, and we found last week as we were closing that he was removed from office. He knew that Paul was innocent, but he continued to hold him as a prisoner. Because basically he was hoping, he kept having interviews with Paul. First of all, you remember it emphasized he specifically with his wife Drusilla wanted to talk with Paul, wanted Paul to preach to him, and Paul did, and it caused him to tremble, but he never did respond to it. And one of the reasons that he kept him in prison, first he wanted to please the Jews, obviously, but also he was hoping that he'd get a little bit of money from Paul. And so his motives were totally wrong. And after about 2 years, then he was removed and replaced by Festus. And we're in the process of looking at that with Festus. And Festus did not have the knowledge or the background with regard to the Jews. Felix had served in various capacities where he had an ongoing relationship with the Jews, and it wasn't always favorable, but he was familiar with them, with their law and their customs. Well, Festus now, he comes in as the governor of Judea, and he really doesn't have that background. So the first thing he does is, which was wise, he goes to Jerusalem, and that is, of course, where the main people that he'll be governing. That is where their council is. The Sanhedrin's there. Their leaders are there. So first thing he does is he goes there, and right away those Jewish leaders ask about Paul. And now remember, this is 2 years later, and they ask about Paul, and they immediately want him to take action against Paul. In fact, they want him to bring Paul from Caesarea to Jerusalem. But Festus really isn't planning to stay there in Jerusalem. He's just there, just again, trying to get to know the people that he's going to be dealing with the most. And so he tells them, no, he's going back to Caesarea and tells them, you come to Caesarea. And they did. And they go through again another sort of hearing. And Festus understands that Paul hasn't done anything wrong at all. And knows that he's an innocent man, sort of surprised by some of the accusations that they have nothing to do whatsoever with Roman law, but more with the Jewish customs in law. And again, he's not familiar with that. And so we find a couple of different things in the text, and I think they're both true. Luke tells us, again, that Festus wants to have favor with the Jews. And as a result of that, he asks Paul if he'll go back to Jerusalem and be tried there. And later on in the chapter, in chapter 25, Festus says that the reason he asked Paul to go back to Jerusalem was because he just simply was at a loss. He did not know how to answer the questions concerning the resurrection of this Jesus and that sort of thing. He had no clue how to deal with that. And that's why he wanted Paul to go back to Jerusalem. And both of those things probably were there's some truth to both of those things. But Paul, and this is sort of where we left off last week, Paul, right when Festus asked Paul if he'd be willing to go back to Jerusalem, at that point, Paul lost all confidence in Festus because he could just tell. Paul was a bright individual, and he could see the writing on the wall. He would know that, yes, Festus does want to please the Jews. And sooner or later, it was going to come about, if he just let things continue in his present course, it would come about that he would be taken to Jerusalem to be tried there. And one thing Paul knows is that he will not get a fair hearing with regard to the Jew. If the Jews are in charge of the thing, he'd have a problem. And he knew that. He knew about their plot to kill him. He knew, of course, everything that he's going through right now is because they've lied about him. They've made things up. They said he's taken a Gentile into the temple. All of that. None of that was true. Paul knows all of that. But he's a Roman citizen. And so right now, you know, he's been dealing with Lysias. He's been dealing with Felix and now with Festus. Those are all Roman authorities. And he always has this hope that if I'm dealing with them, I can still persuade them. But if he's turned over to the Jews, he's not going to be treated fairly. And he knows that. And so once he gets to thinking, Festus is heading, he's leaning in that direction, I'm going to end up back in Jerusalem, standing before the Sanhedrin again, and that's not going to be favorable. I am a Roman citizen. And so sort of as a last straw, he appeals to Caesar. And that's where we left off last week. So let's go back to Acts chapter 25 and notice there again at verse 9. But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, "Do you wish to go up to Jerusalem and there be tried on these charges before me?" But Paul said, "I am standing before Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried. To the Jews, I have done no wrong, as you yourselves know very well." That's just interesting. He knows he has made the case. And Festus knows he hasn't done anything wrong at all. "If then I am a wrongdoer and I have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death," which is sort of an interesting statement there. Paul is not opposed to capital punishment if the person deserves to die. And in this case, him. If he's done something worthy of death, he says, I'm willing to be put to death. But if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. And so he says, I appeal to Caesar. Then Festus, when he had conferred with his council, answered, "To Caesar you have appealed, to Caesar you shall go." And that changes everything. Because now, you know, these Jews are, again, they're still thinking that they can get to Paul. And if he's taken back to Jerusalem, there's still no doubt some of them think they might be able to ambush him and get to him. But that's all off the table now. Because when Paul, as a Roman citizen, appeals to Caesar, the Jews now, they dare not touch him. It's one thing if you're going to ambush just a Jew, another fellow Jew. But now he's a Roman citizen. He has the right to stand before Caesar. And now if the Jews kind of plan and plot to get him, that's no longer, now that he's appealed to Caesar, that's no longer the Jews attacking another Jew. They would be rebelling against the Roman Empire. That would be an attack on Rome to now try to grab Paul, because he's a Roman citizen. He has his rights. He has appealed to Caesar. And so to Caesar, he'll go. And so far as that goes now, then he is not in that danger any longer. Now, you know, technically, I mean, you can have, people are crazy everywhere, aren't they? And you can have an assassin shoot an arrow from it or whatever, you know, that sort of thing. But there's no longer going to be the planning and plotting and that sort of thing because he has appealed to Caesar. And so now all he's going to do is wait. And, you know, that kind of thing didn't happen overnight. It's not like Caesar isn't busy. The Roman emperor has his job and his work to do. And so, you know, things have to be arranged and all of that. And so in the meanwhile, he's going to be staying here at Caesarea waiting for the appropriate time. When, of course, he'll go on what is basically his fourth journey. It's not a missionary journey, but his journey to Rome. And, of course, Paul wants to go to Rome. He has planned to go to Rome. And then he wants to go into Spain. But he had planned to go to Rome in an evangelistic kind of endeavor, not as a prisoner. But it is what it is. It's worked out this way. And so now we're going to be following Paul to Rome as a prisoner. But right now he's still in Caesarea and he's awaiting all of that. So at verse 13 then, we'll pick it up. And at verse 13 it says that now when some days had passed, Agrippa the king and Bernice arrived at Caesarea and greeted Festus. And they're there. Now, this again is a politically correct thing to do. Festus is the new Roman governor in the area. And so it is wise for Agrippa to go and get to know Festus a little bit, or at least to congratulate him on his new job and this sort of thing. And so that's why he and his sister are here. Agrippa, his father, this is King Agrippa II. And he's the great grandson of Herod the Great. And he has been given, I believe it was Claudius who gave him rule over several different sections, a part of Galilee. He was king over, ruler over Abilene. He was ruler over, and a couple other territories he had the rule over. And so that's who he is. We're familiar with him mostly because of this passage before us that you have read through the years and studied. But that's who this is, King Agrippa II. And his sister here is quite the individual. We've talked about Drusilla, remember, and Drusilla would have been this Agrippa and Bernice's sister. And we've said some things about, you remember Felix and Drusilla, and they're kind of, you know, they weren't the greatest morally upright people. And I've heard a lot about Drusilla from other different sources, that she was a little bit unscrupulous for a moral standpoint. Everything that I have read directly about her, I think I can, you know, at least what I have read, you can make the argument that she, as a very young lady, was kind of forced into various situations. And I'll rely on some of the historians and things who pretty much paint a bad picture of her, that they're probably accurate. But most of the things I've read about her, that, you know, things that she, just like with Felix, he kind of stole her from her husband. Now she's in an adulterous relationship. I don't know how much choice she had in all of that as a young. She was probably, but he's at office now, but when we read all of that, she was probably only about 20 years old at that particular time. But Bernice is different. She is without question immoral. She's been married three times. Her first husband was a fellow by the name of Marcus, and I don't know anything else about him but his name. Then she married another Herod, and he was actually her uncle. And he was king of Chalcis, and then he died shortly after. That was his second husband. And then she married another fellow who was the king of Cilicia. And after she was married just for a little while, she deserted him and moved in with her brother, Agrippa. Later on, we find out that this same Bernice becomes the mistress of Vespasian, who was the Roman emperor. And so that says something about it. And after that, she became the mistress of Titus, who was Vespasian's son. And Titus is the one, the general who was in charge during the destruction of Jerusalem and all of that, led the Romans against them. And she became his mistress. So we're not talking about a woman who has a whole lot of morals here. But this is this couple now that Paul is dealing with and is now standing before King Agrippa II. And his sister, Bernice. And so, but as we continue reading, verse 14, it says, and they stayed there many days. Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, there is a man left prisoner by Felix. And when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priest and the elders of the Jews laid out their case against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation against him. That's kind of new information. We've implied it, but that really didn't come out in the beginning of the chapter there when he first arrived at Jerusalem and everything. And Luke tells us that they approached him and talked to him about Paul. It really didn't come out that what they were really asking Festus to do was sentence Paul to death. And now that comes out here, with regard to, as he's telling the story to Agrippa, he tells them that that's what they were asking for. They wanted a charge laid against him of condemnation. And so they really wanted Paul to be put to death. They just didn't know how to go about making it happen, of course. But they certainly want Paul dead. Anyway, it says, and I answered them that it was not custom of Romans to give up anyone before the accused met the accusers face to face and had opportunity to make his defense concerning the charge laid against him. So when they came together here, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought. And when the accusers stood up and they brought no charge against in his case, of such evils as I supposed. Rather, they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who was dead, but whom Paul asserted to be alive. Being at a loss of how to investigate these questions, I asked whether he wanted to go to Jerusalem and be tried there regarding them. But when Paul had appealed to be kept in custody for the decision of the emperor, I ordered him to be held until I could send him to Caesar, which is where he is and what's going on right now. They're just waiting for the appropriate time to send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I would like to hear the man myself. And tomorrow, said he, you will hear him. And this is leading all to chapter 26. And chapter 26 is one of the more familiar chapters in the book of Acts, where Paul stands before King Agrippa. And of course, we'll be getting to that in just a minute. But he says, so on the next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp, and they entered the audience hall and the military tribunes and the prominent men of the city. And then at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. And Festus said, King Agrippa and all who are present with us, you see this man about whom the whole Jewish people petitioned me, both in Jerusalem and here, shouting that he ought not to live any longer. But I found that he had done nothing deserving death. And as he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to go ahead and send him. But I have nothing definite to write to my lord about him. Therefore, I brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after we have examined him, I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable in sending a prisoner not to indicate the charges against him. So you kind of see what's going on here. In chapter 26, Paul is before King Agrippa. It kind of comes across again as another trial, but it's not that at all. They're just digging for information. He's appealed to Caesar. He's not going to be on trial until he stands before Caesar or at least the higher court there. It has been asked before, when someone appeals before to Caesar, does he actually stand before the Roman emperor? And I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure that he doesn't, but I'm not 100% sure that that's the case too. Or if it isn't, just the ones closest to Caesar legally might be the ones that do the case or whatever. But now this is all King Agrippa. I mean, he doesn't have the right or the authority to charge Paul with anything. So this is just a digging for information. And I kind of understand why this is. I mean, Festus really doesn't want to send a prisoner to Caesar and say, this man has appealed to you, but I don't know of any charges or anything like that. So he's still trying to get out something he can put in a letter to Caesar and say, this is what he's being charged. Right now, he doesn't have any, there's no charges even against him officially, because they haven't been able to prove anything. And he says in here, I found him innocent. You see what a terrible situation this is. Everybody keeps finding Paul innocent, but nobody's letting him go. And so just a terrible, what would happen if in our kind of society today, there'd be a great outcry, wouldn't there? This guy is totally innocent. And even the people who are examining him in general, they all say he's innocent, but here he is in bonds. And now he has to go to Rome as a prisoner. But that's the situation. All right, let's get to chapter 26 and this business with King Agrippa. It says, and so Agrippa said to Paul, you have permission to speak out. And notice it says, and Paul stretched out his hand and made his defense. And that kind of, if you're trying to imagine this in your mind's eye, that Paul is getting sort of aggressive here. He's not being real passive. He's starting to make hand gestures and things as he addresses the crowd. He stretches out his hand. And so it's an opportunity for Paul. He's kind of excited as he's going to indicate that he now is able to speak again to somebody who knows a little something about the Jews. And Agrippa certainly did, of course. And so he says at verse 2, I consider myself fortunate that it is before you, King Agrippa, that I am going to make my defense today against all the accusations of the Jews, especially because you are familiar with all the customs and controversies of the Jews. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. And so he's about to preach a sermon, is what he's about to do. He knows this isn't going to be quick. So he asked the king for some patience. And that'd be a good way for me to start my sermons a little bit. So just be a little patient here. But he knows he's going to go into detail with his situation. A lot of this we've already heard. He's going to get into his conversion for the third time. We see this being brought up again. But that's how deep he's going to go as he's dealing with King Agrippa. And so he says, be a little patient with me. He says, my manner of life from my youth, spent from the beginning among my own nation and in Jerusalem, is known by all the Jews. Now remember, we kind of indicated that. Remember we were talking when he was first in Jerusalem and they got him that here. Paul, really, again, he's not a nobody. He was a Pharisee. And he was climbing up the ladder of Judaism. And no doubt some of the Jews would have died by this basically, Paul has now probably been converted for about 25 years or so. So this goes back a little bit. But, you know, we as you think about years and think, can you remember, those of you who are a little bit older, 20 years ago? It doesn't seem that long ago, does it? Really? I mean, I can remember what was going on. I can remember things happening in the church 20 years ago. And sometimes things like, it seems like that was just about 5 years ago. That controversy came up or something. You get to thinking, you know, that was about 2 decades ago that we were wrestling with that. And so 20 years isn't that long. And the point of it is, there's still plenty of Jews who would know who Paul was and how he was climbing up that ladder of Judaism. How he was the one who sat at the feet of Gamaliel, highly educated, well informed. And had a great deal of zeal. And so Paul is just reminding him now, I was known by all the Jews. And they have known for a long time, if they are willing to testify, which of course they're not. But if they are willing to testify that according to the strictest party of our religion, I lived as a Pharisee. And that meant something. The Pharisees were the ones, they were the legal experts of the Jewish law. And not only that, but they had the attitude, they were very strict with regard to the law. They believed that they should follow the law exactly. And they didn't carry that out in their life, but that was their belief. We might say they were like us. They were the conservatives. The Sanhedrin were the liberals. They bent the law a little bit. They didn't believe in fundamental things with regard to the law, like the resurrection and like spirits and angels and those kind of things. The Sadducees, they, outside of the first 5 books of the Bible, they didn't care about much else. And so they were more liberal. But the Pharisees were the ones that would say, put your finger on the passage. They were the ones who were very strict like that. That's why sometimes if you're a member of the Church of Christ, some people call you a Pharisee. You're legalistic. That's what you are. Which we've emphasized many times before. The Pharisees were never, ever condemned by Jesus for being legalist. Which is pretty amazing since that's it. Most people in denominational realms, they condemn the Pharisees for being legalists. But Jesus never did. And then they say to you, you're just like the Pharisees. You're a legalist. Well, where did Jesus ever condemn that? You remember in Matthew chapter 23 what Jesus condemned in the Pharisees. It wasn't because they would say, we have to keep the law. That wasn't their problem. Matthew 23 at verse 1. It says, and then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so do and observe whatever they tell you. Jesus knew. He was familiar with the Pharisees. Whatever they tell you to do, you do it. For they preach, but do not practice. Now, that's the problem. We could have that problem today, can't we? But that was their biggest problem. It wasn't that they said, we're going to keep to the law. We're going to keep the law to the very best of our ability. We're not going to add to or take away. That wasn't what Jesus condemned in them. They preached, but they didn't practice. So that made them hypocrites. And that's, if you're ever guilty of being like a Pharisee, it's because you're living a hypocritical life. We have to guard against preaching, but not practicing. It's one thing to be conservative. That's wonderful and great. It's exactly what we ought to be. But let's make sure that we're making application of the Word of God. Or else we are like the Pharisees. But that's who they were. They were a group of people who believed strongly in keeping the law. At least that's what they preached. And Paul was one of them. And now he's reminding them, back over here in Acts chapter 26, he's reminding them that you Jews, you testify, if you're willing to do so, that I was a Pharisee. He had that same kind of zeal. And now he says, I stand here on trial because of my hope in the promise made by God to our fathers, to which our 12 tribes hope to obtain as they earnestly worship night and day. And for this hope, I am accused by Jews, O king. Why is it thought incredible by any of you that God raises the dead? Now, let me go on just a little bit of an aside here. Because this is kind of interesting that the language that Paul uses here. He is saying, I'm on trial. Because of the hope of Israel. You've heard us talk from time to time. You've heard me preach. You've heard other preachers that you've had here. Maybe all the preachers that you've had here have at one time or another preached on premillennialism. And here's the interesting thing here. Paul is on trial simply because he was preaching and teaching, standing for, believed in the hope of Israel. Now, whatever Paul was teaching and preaching, the Jews there didn't like. Now, that says something, because all Paul's doing is he's preaching the same things that the prophets taught. That's it. In fact, keep your finger there. We'll get back to that thought. Over in Romans chapter 1, you remember Paul as he introduces the great epistle, the Roman letter, as he first begins at verse 1. It says, Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God, which he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures concerning his Son. Now, what's he doing there? He's starting off the book of Romans by saying, everything I write in this book is what the prophets taught. Now, that's all. Paul wasn't introducing any new thing he was just teaching what the prophets taught. And that's sort of back over here in Acts chapter 26 when he talks about, I'm on trial simply for the hope of Israel. He had the true hope that the prophets of old had. But the interesting thing as we think about that in premillennialism is that the Jews were against Paul. Why? Because what he was teaching wasn't what they were hoping for. What were the Jews hoping for in the first century? Anybody know? I know you know. An earthly king. An earthly kingdom. Escape from the Roman yoke. That was their hope. That's what they wanted. They wanted that earthly kingdom. If Paul would have come forward in all his ministry, if he would have been saying, Jesus is here, he's going to rescue us from the Roman yoke, you think the Jews would have been upset with that? No. But that wasn't the true hope of Israel. And the point of it is, the Jews have really lost their way. They don't even realize what the hope of Israel was. The hope of Israel was never an earthly kingdom. The hope of Israel is traced all the way back to the, the promise that God made to Abraham, in thy seed or by thy seed, all families of the earth would be blessed. It was spiritual in nature. It wasn't a physical kingdom that was really the great promise or the most significant part of the promise. It was salvation through Christ, through the Messiah. And that's what Paul preached. And that was the real hope of Israel. And it's interesting now that premillennialists today, which has infiltrated almost every denominational church, you find a denominational church that doesn't believe in the rapture, that doesn't believe in Armageddon, that doesn't believe in the tribulation period. And there are some denominations that don't believe that, but most denominations all are caught up in that. But the very fundamental aspect of premillennialism is the kingdom. That's the building block. That's the foundation of everything else they teach. Jesus came to set up a kingdom. He failed to set up that earthly kingdom. So he's coming back to reign on earth for 1,000 years in this earthly kingdom. That's their hope. You know what that hope is? That hope is exactly the hope that the Jews who were against Paul hoped for. That's what they wanted. They lost their way. And it's interesting to me, premillennialism, they're standing exactly where all of these Jews who are against Paul and now have him as a prisoner, they're standing exactly where they stood. Paul's in trouble simply because he believed in and he taught and he preached the hope of Israel. It wasn't for an earthly kingdom. If it was, the Jews wouldn't have had any problem with him. But he's teaching the truth. The same truth that we ought to grasp, the same truth that we ought to be telling people about. Not some paradise here on earth, but salvation in and through Jesus Christ. And a relationship with him that leads not to earth, but to heaven. That's the real hope. That has always been the hope of Israel. And so it's interesting that Paul uses this kind of language as he's standing before King Agrippa. Now remember, King Agrippa was familiar with the Jews and their law and their customs. So he's hoping that this all will resonate with him just a little bit. And it does kind of as we work our way through this. Only like Felix, he doesn't respond much. But notice then at the last part of that, why is it thought incredible by any of you that God raises the dead? They shouldn't be shocked by that. We think sometimes that's a New Testament doctrine. It is, but it's an Old Testament doctrine too. Read Isaiah chapter 26 at verse 19 sometime. It talks about a resurrection. You remember after Lazarus died and Jesus went there and Martha was talking to Jesus. What does he say about her brother Lazarus to Jesus? You remember? That's right. He would not have died, but he did die. And so what does he have hope in? I'll see him again in the resurrection at the last day. I wonder why she believed, as a Jew, I wonder why she believed that. Because the Old Testament taught that. It taught the resurrection. It taught and prophesied even about the resurrection of Christ. Psalms 16, of course, emphasized the fact that Jesus would not be left in Hades. Acts 2 quoted Psalm 16 and talked about that. The resurrection is not just a New Testament doctrine. It's an Old Testament doctrine. So Paul is saying, why do you think it's incredible? That's what our hope really is based on. Salvation through Christ is based upon the fact that he has been raised from the dead. And that's all I'm teaching. Why do you find that incredible? I myself was convinced that I ought to do many things in opposing the name of Jesus of Nazareth. I did so in Jerusalem, and I not only locked up many of the saints in prison after receiving authority from the chief priest, but when they were put to death, I cast my vote against them. Which shows how severe it got when Paul was still Saul of Tarsus and he was persecuting the church. There were Christians like you and me, average, everyday Christians, who were losing their life. Paul was going door to door and dragging people out of their homes, not just men, but men and women, and many of them were dying, were being put to death. It's pretty incredible to think about how intense that was. And Paul's reminding them, he was behind all of that. He was giving his vote against them. He says, and I punished them often in all the synagogues, and I tried to make them blaspheme in raging fury against them. I persecuted them even to foreign citizens, to foreign cities. Now, what did he say? Remember what he said a few verses before? You all know this is true, if you'll just testify. I mean, he was making such an issue out of all of this, such an uproar, making havoc of the church, that people would know what was going on. The other Jews would know, this Paul, boy, he's aggressive. And people were losing their lives, and he was the one behind it all, and he's telling you, you should remember that. And many of them, no doubt, without any doubt in my mind at least, they would remember all of these things. But they weren't really that sincere. But he said, I persecuted them even to foreign cities. To cities. So then the question becomes, if that's the way Paul was, what in the world changed? How did he go from there, going into the synagogues and persecuting people, dragging men and women out of their homes, willing to go all the way from Jerusalem to Damascus just to persecute the church? What changed? And again, we've on two occasions have seen this, and he's about to get into it for the third time. So we'll not discuss it as we have in the past. We'll just read it. But he says, in this connection, I journeyed to Damascus with the authorities and commission of the chief priest. At midday, O king, I saw on the way a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, and that shone around me and those who journeyed with me. And when we had all fallen to the ground, I heard a voice saying in me in the Hebrew language, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It is hard for you to kick against the goals. And I said, who are you, Lord? And the Lord said, I am Jesus who you are persecuting. But rise and stand upon your feet. I have appeared to you for this purpose, to appoint you as a servant and witness to the things in which you have seen me, and to those in which I will appear to you, delivering you from the people, from the Gentiles to whom I am sending you, to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light, from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and a place among those who are sanctified by faith in me. Now, as Paul is saying all of that even, there's some part of that that must have felt good to him. Why? He's thinking back. This is what Jesus told him on the road to Damascus. How much of this stuff has he done? All of it. He's done all of this. He's been used exactly the way Jesus wanted to use him. I wonder if we can think back to ourselves and just as we close tonight and just think, I wonder, is God really using me the way he wants to? Am I allowing God to use me the way he wants to? Paul could look back and say, yes, everything Jesus said, I've done all of that. And we ought to have that kind of mentality as well. All right, we'll pick up there next week. Appreciate your attention.